Good morning, everyone. It's nice to see so many people here so early in the morning. What I'm going to do is describe a community-based or community-level intervention for the prevention of inhalant abuse. And I have no financial relationships to disclose. So let me begin by giving just a little bit of background on inhalants. I'm not sure that everyone here has great familiarity with this topic. The National Institute on Drug Abuse defines inhalants as volatile substances that produce chemical vapors that can be inhaled to induce a psychoactive or mind-altering effect. Inhalants include a wide variety of substances. The kind of defining characteristic of them, even though lots of substances can be inhaled, is that they are rarely, if ever, ingested in any other way other than inhalation. There's four broad categories of inhalants. They include volatile solvents, such as paint thinners, dry cleaning fluids, gasoline, glues, correction fluids, and felt tip markers. Aerosols, such as spray paints, deodorants, hairsprays, and so forth. Gases, including anesthetics like chloroform, ether, and nitrous oxide, also known as laughing gas, as well as other products such as butane lighters, propane tanks, and refrigerants. And then another group of inhalants called nitrites. Street names include, you know, poppers or snappers, and they're very different than other kinds of inhalants, and talk a little bit about that in a minute. The kind of psychoactive effects of these products are, with one exception, the nitrites, they're all central nervous system depressants, so kind of in the same category of alcohol as alcohol, sedatives, and anesthetics. The intoxicating effects are very similar to alcohol, so there's kind of this initial stimulation followed by loss of inhibition, drowsiness, and lightheadedness. The effects tend to be very quick but short-lasting. Nitrites, by comparison, are they dilate the blood vessels and relax the muscles. There's kind of a sense of kind of warmth and excitation that comes with those. The health effects include sudden sniffing death syndrome as the most dramatic health effect. Obviously, that's death, and it's related primarily to cardiac arrest. The long-term effects of inhalant abuse vary with the type of inhalant, but can include such things as weight loss, muscle weakness, disorientation, lack of coordination, irritability, depression, liver and kidney damage, and central nervous system damage. So a little bit about kind of the prevalence of these substances. This is annual prevalence from the Monitoring the Future survey. One of the notable things about inhalant abuse is that its prevalence rates are highest at younger ages. So most of you, I'm sure, are familiar with the Monitoring the Future survey. It's done at 8th, 10th, and 12th grades. And so you see that at 8th grade, the annual prevalence over the past 10 years has ranged from around 7.8% to about 9.5%, and then it decreases in 10th and 12th grade. The other thing you'll notice is that there's been a slightly downward trend over the past 10 years, or mostly over the past like 7 or 8 years, and there hasn't been a huge variability, more variability at the 8th grade level, but very little variability at 10th and 12th grade. This next slide presents the 30-day prevalence rate. You can see, again, this is from Monitoring the Future in the same grades. And here, even more dramatically, you see that there's very little variation. So for, at 8th grade, you know, the rates have ranged over the last 10 years from about 3.6% to 4.4%. Okay. By comparison to other substances commonly abused by adolescents, you see that it doesn't have the same prevalence as alcohol, marijuana, and cigarettes, the most commonly abused substances. The other thing you'll notice, of course, is that, as we mentioned earlier, inhalants decrease over time as, you know, youth get older, but other substance abuse increases. So it's a very different sort of substance. Okay, so the community-level intervention I'm going to describe was developed and implemented by a community coalition known as SAFE, Substance Abuse Free Environments Incorporated. It was established in 1999, And their mission statement says that they are to engage the community in working together to prevent substance abuse, primarily emphasizing working with community partners and focusing on environmental strategies. Their primary funding source is the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, but they also receive smaller amounts of funding from state and local grants, donations, and workshop fees. SAFE is located in Chesterfield County, Virginia. It's a large suburban county immediately south of Richmond, Virginia. The population is 316,000 with over 59,000 public school students. Their racial makeup is about 68% white, 22% black, 7% Hispanic, and 3% Asian. That largely mirrors the state's racial and ethnic breakdown, although they have a slightly higher percentage of Hispanics and a little bit lower percentage of Asians. It's a relatively wealthy community or county. The median household income is $70,000. That compares to the state median income of around $59,000, which actually is relatively high on a national level. So this whole effort began with a school survey. So as part of the Community Coalition SAFE's kind of routine efforts, they were conducting they got the public schools in Chesterfield County to conduct a school survey as part of their needs assessment. And so this was done in 2005. The survey was the Prevention Needs Assessment Survey developed by Bach Harrison, and it's very similar to the Communities That Care survey, and one of the authors was involved in the development of the Communities That Care survey. And it's also very similar to the Monitoring the Future in terms of the substance abuse frequency and type of substance items. So that's really nice, so you can kind of compare results from the Chesterfield survey to the National Monitoring the Future survey. And like the Monitoring the Future survey, it was conducted of all youth in the 8th, 10th, and 12th grades. In this case, though, it was only conducted of youth whose parents gave active consent. The sample size was 2,501, which represented about 19% of youth in the 8th, 10th, and 12th grades. So this is kind of the results of that initial survey from 2005. And what's obviously very striking is that their 30-day prevalence for inhalant use was nearly double the national rate for 8th graders. It was about 50% higher for 10th grade, and then by 12th grade it really kind of decreased to a rate comparable to the national rate. So this was a pretty significant and finding from the survey. By comparison, what's also kind of, I think, really interesting is when you look at the prevalence rate for other substances, it's dramatically lower than the national rate. So again, inhalants, double the national rate, but cigarettes, less than half the national rate, alcohol, you know, several percent less than the national rate, and marijuana, less than 50% of the national rate. So it kind of jumps out at you that this is something that needs to be addressed. So SAFE developed an intervention. It was kind of multiple strategies, multiple settings sort of intervention. And one of the things that kind of characterized their approach to inhalant abuse was they approached it not as an addictive or abusable substance, but more as a safety issue. So that inhalants are a dangerous product, you know, both dangerous to the individual who's doing the inhaling, as well as creating fire hazards and so forth. So that was kind of their overall approach to this issue. So their intervention included 5 core strategies. There was a media campaign to create parent and community awareness. There were public service announcements on the radio. There were television interviews. There were television ads. There were special events with outside speakers. There were featured articles in the newspaper. There were advertisements in community newspapers and so forth. They also targeted professionals who work with youth. So mental health clinicians, substance abuse clinicians, child welfare workers, the police, juvenile court staff, and so forth. They put on several workshops for these people, teaching them about what inhalant abuse is, what the signs of abuse are, how it can be addressed, and so forth. They also focused a lot on elementary and middle school staff, not only teachers, but also administrative staff, school counselors, school social workers, parents, and students. But interestingly, they didn't work with students at all until the third year of this effort. Fourth strategy was decreasing accessibility to products at school and home. That was part of their kind of community awareness program, but particularly in the schools, what they did was they worked with the schools to get them to remove abusable products from the school supply list, so the list of supplies that all students are required to purchase at the beginning of the year, and substitute them with products that could not be abused. They also worked with the schools to remove abusable products from the schools themselves. And then finally, modifying school policies to address inhalant issues. So what they did here was, there was no mention of inhalant abuse in the student code of conduct, so that was added to the student code of conduct, and they also established procedures for how schools should address inhalants in the case of finding a student who abuses inhalants. Okay, so this is kind of what happened subsequent to their intervention at both 2 years and, even though it says 2010, it's actually about 2.5 years later. So again, and I'm only focusing on eighth grade because that's when use peaks and the results are most dramatic, but actually you see the same pattern for 10th and 12th graders. So you see that inhalant use dropped from 8.2% to 4.6% 2 years after SAFE initiated their intervention. And went from, you know, double the national rate to just a little bit, just a few, well, not even a full percentage, higher than the national rate. And then after another 2.5 years, dropped even further to 3%, and now at a rate lower than the national rate for prevalence of inhalant use. Another interesting finding is that there is a gender difference in inhalant use, and girls tend to use inhalants more frequently than boys. And you see this both at the national level as well as in Chesterfield, although in Chesterfield the rates were very similar, 8.7% and 8.2%. Thank you. But what's really interesting is this intervention seemed to have the biggest impact on boys. So you see that for girls, the rate decreased from 8.7% in 2005 to 5.1% in 2010, a 41% decrease. But for boys, it decreased from 8.2% to 1.5%, an 82% decrease. Obviously, something's going on here with the intervention. We really have no idea why there would have been this dramatic decrease for boys, especially since it doesn't follow a pattern at the national level. Seems to be unique to Chesterfield County. So a word about some of the limitations of this. First, I should note that this project was not done as a research study. So this is really kind of post hoc, looking back at what occurred and trying to make some sense of it. So obviously this is a case study. It's N of one, so it's subject to all the kind of threats to internal and external validity that come with that methodology. The other thing is that, as I mentioned, the 2005 survey employed active parental consent. However, the 2007 and 2010 surveys used passive parental consent. I'm sure that that made a difference in who completed the survey, but I frankly can't see exactly how it might have biased results. Actually, I would have thought that if anything, it would have been the reverse because of who would have completed the survey. Because you would expect that parents who really involved in their children's lives, who monitor their behavior, would have been more likely to give consent. And those, we know that parental monitoring is closely related to substance abuse, so not really sure what's going on there. The other thing is that the survey, as I mentioned, was done at slightly different times each year. So in 2005, the survey was administered in November, roughly the same time period in 2007. It was November and December. But in 2010, the survey was conducted in February, March, and April, and actually just a little bit in the beginning of April. That also could be a problem. Typically, kids who get in trouble, engage in delinquent behavior, abuse substances, are more likely to drop out of school, be suspended, and so forth. But that would be, especially in terms of dropping out of school, that would be more likely to occur at older grades, particularly 12th grade. But here at 8th grade, it's not likely to have as large of an effect. So again, I'm not really sure what effect this may have had, but despite that, it seemed that there was certainly a large decrease in the prevalence of substance use or inhalant use. So next steps, we're actively preparing an application to NIH to do a randomized controlled trial of the SAFE intervention. It's a collaboration between the Pacific Institute for Research and Evaluation, SAFE, and Virginia Commonwealth University. And since we're preparing it for a January submission, I'm not going to go into any details about what our design is. I will mention, though, that we've recruited 16 rural communities in Virginia to serve as research sites. 8 will be assigned to the SAFE intervention and 8 to a placebo control condition. And finally, I just want to acknowledge Megan Munn, my graduate research assistant who helped prepare the charts, and Paris Bach-Harrison. She administered the survey and provided me with the data that I could use to prepare this presentation. Thank you very much. And I guess we have a minute or two for questions. Great. Yeah.
Can you speak to why the students weren't included in the early, you said that the parents and staff
Well, I think it was largely a matter of resources, but also I think, they felt that they, one of the things, what they were trying to do, really kind of the focus of the intervention was removing, trying to decrease access to these products, and where there was no safe alternative, no, non-abusable alternative, to encourage teachers and parents to closely monitor and supervise their use. So they really felt that was the most important part of the intervention. And so I think it's a combination of resources and just what they thought would be most effective. Okay, thank you very much.